Welcome to Bristol Bay and Beyond for December 19th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Coming up in this half hour, a conversation with Robin Samuelson about President Obama's executive action this week protecting Bristol Bay. We'll visit one Dillingham man keeping Hanukkah tradition, and Dr. Kathy Heineman discusses the importance of prenatal care. That and more after a brief look back at some of the news of the week. Volleyball and wrestling for Bristol Bay teams wrapped up last weekend. Kilogunik took third place in the 2A state tournament after beating Dillingham in the consolation match, the Lady Wolverines finishing fifth overall. In the wrestling tournament, Kotzebue finished in the top spot this year, with Bethel not far behind. Neustiahawk put three wrestlers in the top six spots at state, and Dillingham had seven in the top six. Wolverine wrestler Kenny Saville was a state champ at 126 pounds. Searchers on the Kuskokwim River have still not found the bodies of two missing travelers after an ATV went into the river last Thursday. A third on the ATV, Ralph DeMontle of Akiak, was found last Sunday. Some 50 volunteers from several villages are still continuing the search. Subway restaurant opened Monday in Dillingham. Proprietor Andrew Burkowski welcomed elders for a special lunch that day and said at the time that things were off to a good start.
Great. I'm impressed with the staff. They got them through the line quickly, and honestly, I see an awful lot of smiling faces here. It looks like some people are very happy.
Subway opened to the general public at 4 Monday, and a line stretched to the door for 3 solid hours until Dillingham's first fast food franchise ran out of bread. A foot-long turkey was the first sandwich ordered at Dillingham's Subway. Late Monday night or Tuesday morning, the Togiak Health Clinic was broken into and vandalized. Two young men, aged 17 and 18, were named as suspects, and some of the stolen material was found in their possession by the VPSO. However, the damages done to the clinic shut down its operations for 2 days as crews scrambled to repair the electrical and communication systems to get the village's only health care facility back open to the public. Perhaps the biggest news of the week came when President Obama signed an executive order barring oil and gas leasing or development in federal waters offshore of Bristol Bay. The president took to YouTube to tout the importance of his actions.
Bristol Bay has supported Native Americans in the Alaska region for centuries. It supports about $2 billion in the commercial fishing industry, supplies America with 40% of its wild-caught seafood. It is a beautiful natural wonder, and it's something that's too precious for us to just be putting out to the highest bidder.
Robin Samuelson of Dillingham, who has helped lead the effort to see a permanent moratorium on oil and gas development in Bristol Bay for years, stopped by KDLG Tuesday after the president signed the order. Samuelson said it was a good day for Bristol Bay.
Yes, it is. You know, this battle started about 25, 30 years ago. One of the lead architects against opening the offshore oil and gas was my father, Harvey Samuelson, who passed away. And, you know, we've had presidents that removed the moratorium and then presidents that put it in place. We had governors that wanted offshore oil and gas to happen in the North Aleutian Basin. We had governors that didn't want it to happen. And in the 80s, when Exxon Valdez happened, the North Aleutian Basin was open for oil and gas development. But because of what happened in Prince William Sound, they withdrew Bristol Bay. Congress did. In 2011, it again opened up under the orders of President Bush, and President Obama decided, no, I'm gonna pull it and put it on hold. And today's action put it on a timeline that somewhere way, way out in the future that oil and gas could be developed.
For the folks that are together in what's known as the Fish Basket Coalition, this is about as good as could have been hoped for, I think, or am I wrong there?
You're absolutely right. This is something that we had two choices, go for the Antiquities Act or go for what President Obama did today. The Antiquities Act would have been a harder measure to have pass. And now under what President Obama has done, commercial fishing could still happen in that area. So, you know, we're very pleased with what he's done today.
What's the main threat from opening any of this to oil and gas development?
Well, if you look at the geographic location, how Bristol Bay is laid out there in the federal waters, if oil and gas was allowed out there, and let's say there was an oil spill, That oil isn't going to go anywhere but go into Bristol Bay and hold in Bristol Bay based on the water patterns. You know, we have not only our salmon that migrate out, that smolt, go through that area, but our adult salmon come back. The world's largest crab nursery grounds is right in that area.
There are other fisheries we don't talk about very much.
No.
There's a sole fishery, there's halibut.
Halibut, it's a main halibut nursery grounds. I mean, this is, you know, the president said this is a $2 billion fishery. This is a $5, $10 billion fishery.
What did it take to get here today? What sort of political tugging and pulling has it taken to get this to Mr. Obama's desk?
Well, you know, this has been a 25, 30-year battle. And there was those of us that were involved. My father's passed away 10 years. Terry Hefferly, who ran BB&A for a good number of years, has moved out of the region. But it was constant. It was constant, not on a daily basis, but, you know, once or twice a year, bringing it up. I visited back in D.C. last year and met with President Obama's people and said, we've got to do something. We can't allow oil and gas to happen out there. And this spring, the president agreed with me and got his team working on doing a draft, and today we heard the draft.
The concern may be that this could unravel under a different administration. Could it?
Yeah, I think Congress and the president of the United States can unravel it, but it's going to be a hard unraveling for them.
Are we taking away the potential for another industry that could have an economic benefit to the people in our region?
I'm not against offshore oil and gas development. I'm not against mining. But the two, the Pebble Mine and the jobs out at the North Aleutian Basin made available, you know, our workforce would probably be around 2-3%. Most of the people up on the North Slope are from Oklahoma and Texas and whatnot. We're a state that gives away its resources. And, you know, we can't take the risk. We have a Pebble Mine. We have a North Slope. And that's our fishery in Bristol Bay. Why risk it?
Again, that was Robin Samuelson of Dillingham speaking with us Tuesday. Many of us will celebrate Christmas next week, and many more will celebrate Orthodox Christmas in a few weeks after that, but Jews around the world begin celebrating Hanukkah this week. Eric Salinger invited me to his Dillingham home Wednesday to see more about Hanukkah's traditions.
So these are latkes, and you make them to kind of commemorate the miracle of Hanukkah. So most Jewish holidays are sort of centered around a miracle or some sort of general awesomeness.
The miracle here happened in the 2nd century BC after the Maccabean Revolt had wrestled control of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem back from the Syrian Greek occupiers. Afterwards, Jewish priests could only find enough oil to keep the temple's menorah lit for just one night, but instead the flame stayed lit for eight. Jews have celebrated the rededication of the temple and the candle's miraculous burning for centuries, and as with most holiday traditions, Hanukkah has adopted some of its own modern customs over the years.
So, in a really great transition, for Hanukkah, you fry as many things as you possibly can to commemorate that everlasting oil. So, in America, we do latkes. In Israel, they do sufganiyot, which are like a jelly donut, deep-fried jelly donut. Really, anything deep-fried will do, but these are kind of the food of choice for most American Jews.
Latkes are no unleavened bread or bitter herb, and as Salinger runs down the ingredients, it's easy to see why Americans, Jewish and otherwise, appreciate them during the Hanukkah week.
You get shredded potatoes, an egg, mashed potatoes, a little bit of flour, baking powder, salt, pepper, onion, garlic, and in these, cheese.
In lieu of traditional American toppings of ketchup or applesauce, Salinger dished out his latkes with a dose of mixed cream and sriracha, and they were delicious. There aren't many other Jewish people in Dillingham, if any, at the moment, and I ask him if celebrating the holiday alone is difficult.
No, I don't really find it that hard. I think everybody that lives out here, it's not from Dillingham originally, kind of feels a little far from family, and it's not a whole lot different than that.
Here's a young professional Jewish man from back east, keeping tradition in his cabin in the woods in a remote town in Alaska. It's no stretch to see the Dr. Joel Fleischman similarity, something Salinger says he's heard plenty.
Every person I meet down south is convinced that my life must be exactly like Northern Exposure.
And it is to a degree, with the caveat that Salinger is an attorney where Fleischman was Sicily's town doc. Jews, he says, are long accustomed to moving and often ending up far away from family and community.
Well, we're kind of historically traveling people. Once the original temple was completely wiped out, you sort of had to adapt to living in the diaspora all over the world. So one of the things they do is it's one of the first religions to sort of transition away from a central temple into sort of being able to pray anywhere. So wherever you are, anywhere on planet Earth, you can be Jewish. But the idea is that you're supposed to have a minyan, which is 10 people. You get together 10 other Jews, and that's enough to sort of go through the typical rites of prayer and have a fantastic Jewy time.
Other Jewish traditions this season can prove difficult to replicate in Dillingham, too, like celebrating Christmas.
You watch a movie, because the movie theaters are open, and you go to a Chinese restaurant, because they're the only restaurants open. It's the one day a year, you know, everyone in town is Jewish, because they're all at a Chinese restaurant or all at a movie theater.
The 8 days of Hanukkah this year run through December 24th, and on Wednesday, Salinger lights another candle. He does have a menorah, just not exactly a traditional one. His is digital, and it's playing on his TV.
It's streaming from a computer right now. It's very safe. It's a great menorah. Can't burn down. Lights itself. It's pretty easy. But the prayer you say over it is, Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kidishanu bo mitzvotav, vitzivanu lahadlik ner shel Hanukkah.
Eric Salinger celebrating Hanukkah this week in Dillingham. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Yesterday, climber and Arctic veteran Lonnie Dupree left Talkeetna for his fourth attempt to be the first person to summit Denali in the month of January. Before he left, he spoke with KTNA's Philip Manning for this.
Climbing Denali is hard. Even in peak season, temperatures dip below zero and frostbite is a real concern. In fact, this summer saw one of the lowest summit rates in decades, owing largely to the weather. Not many people attempt North America's highest peak in the winter. Lonnie Dupree is one of the few who has. He's just left on his fourth winter attempt of Denali and hopes to summit by the end of January. His previous attempts were all thwarted by the weather. Dupree says he's surprised at how mild the Alaskan winter has been so far.
I'm surprised on how little snow and how warm it's been in Alaska overall. I mean, that's opens up a whole new bit of news maybe on climate change and what's going on with the weather these days.
Lonnie Dupree takes climate change seriously. Many of his expeditions have been to raise awareness for the changing environment. Despite the warmer-than-normal temperatures in the lowlands of Alaska, however, Dupree says it will still be very cold on Denali, with temperatures potentially dipping to 50 below zero. Under those conditions, Lonnie Dupree says the body requires a lot of calories just to keep going.
It's like throwing a log on the fire, right? You got to keep the firewood coming when you're up there. So that's very, very important.
Lonnie Dupree estimates he'll be taking in about 4,500 calories per day to keep his internal furnace running. Even so, he expects to come back 15 pounds lighter than when he left. He says that hydration is even more important and that he plans to drink 4 or 5 liters of melted snow water each day. Daylight is also a major factor affecting winter climbs. Lonnie Dupree will only have a handful of hours each day to try to make progress.
A big challenge is, aside from the cold, is you only have a limited amount of time to travel because it's dark. I'm leaving darkest time of the year, so it's only leaves you maybe 5 hours of usable light in mid-December.
Crevasses present a challenge to Denali climbers regardless of the season. Without team members, Lonnie Dupree will be on his own should he find himself in an area where crevasses have opened.
As a preventative measure to not drop into one of those bad boys is to take a big long pair of skis, and I'm taking a spruce pole, about a 13-foot long spruce pole with me.
Like much of his gear, Lonnie's 8-foot long skis are custom. In fact, he made them himself. This year, he's also bringing along a tent, sleeping bag, and down suit that should help him stay warm. Overall, Dupree feels good about this year's attempt.
You always get those butterflies in your stomach right before you go. But I'm excited to get moving. I'm feeling really good about this year. I've trained hard. I have all the equipment that I could wish for, for this trip.
As with his previous attempts, Lonnie Dupree's primary goal is to get back safely. Though reaching the summit of Denali would be a definite plus. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The Christmas bird count for the areas around Dillingham and King Salmon is scheduled for tomorrow. The annual event draws participation from experts and novices alike, whose tallies combine with counts from all across the Americas in what's billed as the longest-running citizen science survey in the world. Michael Swaim at the Togiak Refuge office in Dillingham is the point of contact for the CBC here. For those who haven't participated before, Swaim says it's an easy and fun event that doesn't have to take all day.
You should spend at least a half hour kind of dedicated counting, whether that be a feeder watch or out walking or skiing or snow machining or that sort of thing.
Dillingham and King Salmon turn in neither big numbers of participants nor big numbers of birds for their Christmas bird counts, but Swaim says in the bigger picture of things, every little bit helps to compile a useful scientific database that's accessible to researchers and the public alike.
There's literally tens of thousands of observers recording millions and millions of birds, and could seem that what we see is pretty insignificant, but it's really not. It's just a component of the whole, and the information we do get here is important. Tracking trends as well as the distribution of winter birds and where they occur and where they don't occur. So it all adds up, and it's all important.
Some of the uncommon birds that are exciting to see during the Christmas bird count are American dippers, white-crowned and white-throated sparrows, hawk owls, goshawk, Townsend solitaire, and brambling, and there are plenty of more. We have details posted at our website, kdlg.org. Well, a few weeks ago, Dr. Kathy Heineman from the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation's Kanakanak Hospital interviewed with KDLG News about a sensitive topic. She said the hospital was concerned that babies were being born addicted to opiates like heroin. The hospital is now testing all pregnant women for opiate use, not to get them into any trouble, but rather to try to help the mother know more about the signs of withdrawal her child may experience after birth. At the time, Dr. Heineman said she would like to talk more about the importance of prenatal care in general, and we eagerly invited her back for that conversation. Doctor, thanks for coming back.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You're here to talk about prenatal care and the importance of it. Why this topic, and what's on your mind this week specifically about this?
I think I have two things on my mind. Number one, it's clear to me that some folks aren't really aware what goes into prenatal care and what providers are looking for when we see a prenatal patient. And I think it's also important for the pregnant women themselves to know what to look for in themselves with an eye toward when to call and when is it a normal thing and when should they really be getting some attention.
Let's start with what prenatal care is. I suppose when would a woman who has realized she's pregnant begin to come see you for the first time?
We usually like to see ladies between 8 and 12 weeks of pregnancy. Now, a good question to ask is how do we figure out how when they're 8 or 12 weeks? Well, we go by the first day of their last menstrual period. So that would that first week of their last menstrual period is the first week of pregnancy by the way we count it. Second week, they're not even pregnant yet. They don't get pregnant till about 14 days after they start their period. Then we would count them as 3 weeks pregnant, mostly because we know when their last period was. We don't know exactly when they got pregnant. So you missed your first period at about 4 weeks by the way we count pregnancy. And there are many women who have miscarriages before they even realize they're pregnant. That's why we try to wait to about 8 weeks or so before we start seeing them. Not because we're trying to not do it, but because there's some statistics that suggest that up to 50% of people, or up to 50% of pregnancies end in spontaneous miscarriage.
So now they're in your office. What's a prenatal care visit? Are you coaching them on healthy things? Or are you guiding them on what things they should come in for later care?
I would hope so.
Okay.
There's sort of a couple of different kinds of visits. The first prenatal visit is the most thorough visit. There are a whole list of questions that I need to find out from the woman. Does she have medical problems that predated her pregnancy? For instance, women with diabetes have to have their diabetes in exceptionally good control prior to even trying to conceive for the best outcome for the baby. Does the woman have a previous history of some sort of condition, a seizure disorder or depression or something else for which she's taking medicine regularly? Because some medicines are fine in pregnancy and some medicines absolutely need to be stopped. Does the woman have a pre-existing blood pressure problem? Among the questions that we ask at that first prenatal visit are also questions about education. Sometimes people have different learning styles, and knowing what their educational level may help us gear our educational efforts toward them better.
Are you seeing all the women that you hope come in for their prenatal visits, or are women sometimes hesitant to come in for any reasons?
I think there are some women that are hesitant to come in, and I wish I could do something to make it easier for them to come in. I think sometimes people feel something and they're afraid they're going to be told something that they don't want to hear.
All of us are probably that way.
I think so.
Okay. There's probably steps that the medical team can take, the providers can take, to make for a better outcome the sooner they visit?
I think it depends on the sort of the stage in pregnancy.
Okay.
I think when we talk about normal prenatal care, a first visit sometime between 8 and 12 weeks of pregnancy, visits roughly monthly thereafter till about 30 weeks in pregnancy, and visits every 2 weeks from 30 to 36 weeks, and then weekly after that. Why did we pick those numbers? Heck if I know, except that normally that first trimester up to 12 weeks is fairly quiet, but it's good to get an idea what's going on with a woman. Between the first and the third trimester, we're watching for things like diabetes showing up in that 30 to 36 week range. Blood pressure can become much more of an issue. Those things can be caught early by regularly checking your blood pressure, regularly checking the urine for protein, and asking questions about certain symptoms that can go along with those problems.
Are there any issues specific to our area concerning normal pregnancies?
Yes. Over the last 5 years, we have become much more aware, and the folks at ANMC have also become much more aware, of a condition called intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy, which is a mouthful.
Not a term any of us would know what it means, obviously, but...
What it means is, inside the liver, there are the pipes that hold the bile, the juice that the liver makes to help digest food. When those pipes get gummy and the liver bile is sort of backs up in the liver, it winds up running around in the blood. In the woman, that causes itching of the skin. Generally speaking, pretty severe itching, and specifically itching of the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet. For the woman, it's an annoying thing, and it goes away the minute she has her, well, it starts to go away as soon as she has her baby. The problem is that for the baby, it can be a fatal thing.
Why?
They are not exactly sure why, but they do know that at about 36 weeks, they need to be starting to make plans to get that baby delivered.
And that's early by?
That is early by standard. Normal pregnancy goes up to 40 weeks the way we count it.
Okay, so up to a month early induced pregnancy on account of this condition?
That's correct. Mm. To avoid babies dying within their mama's uteruses because of this intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy.
So pregnant women and friends and family of pregnant women should watch for signs of itchy skin.
Yes. But it once again becomes one of those cases where we live in a land of dry air and we're about to enter the dry time of the of the year. So
all have dry skin.
Yeah, who isn't itching? However, the issue is itching on the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet is kind of unusual for winter skin.
Okay. Prenatal visit also gives you the opportunity to talk about alcohol, drugs, tobacco, diet, exercise, all the things that maybe we're not aware of just how important they are, but you probably are.
Right. What I often tell women are that strong women give birth more easily. My gosh, the women around here give birth beautifully. I did my residency down in West Virginia. And okay, we got a lot of farm women, but by golly, we had a lot of C-sections too. And there were there were just some, I'm just so impressed with the strength that is shown by the women. I am impressed with the strength and support that their families give them during the birthing process. People that I just hadn't really thought would show strength, I have been amazed when I've been had the honor of catching the baby.
How many babies have you delivered since you've been here?
Well over 100.
Well over 100. Since 2000?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you recognize now, 14, 15-year-olds that are walking around?
It was the coolest thing ever when I saw one of the kids that I had delivered playing in sports, and it was like, oh, I delivered him.
Oh, that's got to be great, huh?
Oh, it is. Huh. It is.
Well, Dr. Catherine Heineman from the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation, thank you so much for joining us again.
You're welcome.
And we'll end this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond with a radio essay submitted to us from our friend Abayu Moore. Abayu is probably a stranger to none of our listeners, as she has become one of the most recognized artists in Bristol Bay, maybe in Alaska. This winter, she and her husband Chris and their two young children are spending time as caretakers at the Mission Lodge in Aleknagik. Here, Abayu shares thoughts on how being a mother is shaping the way she looks at the world, hopefully more through the eyes of a child.
Having two kids is such a blessing. When you devote your love to one child, you feel like there couldn't possibly be room for another, and then there is. And the way you love each baby is different, but the same. Having different things you adore about each baby, but not holding it against the other for not being the same. In fact, loving their differences in addition to their likeness. Having love gush triggers for certain facial expressions, where you swoon for how perfectly imperfect they are, and feel that your life is fulfilled with every desire at that moment. There is no hunger, sadness, or politics in the world. Everything is satisfied for those brief moments. It's like having bursts of miracles in your life, because the reality of life is that nothing is perfect, but it is a miracle that you could honestly forget about any negativity for true moments while loving your child. I never felt that before being a mom. We wonder how people become parents when we can only see the face value of parenthood and it all seems like a struggle. The reason people love having children is because it truly brings hope that the world could be better if we remembered to live more like children. Somewhere, society found the gall to praise adult ego when realistically we should ignore egotistic nature and follow the true path of happiness that is most clear through the eyes of our children. It's not have less children because we overpopulate the earth. It should be listen to the children because they will save the world. My kids have given me the gift of less ego, and it is clear to me that they aren't the ones who want more toys and things. It is adults who are pushing consumption and waste on them. They tell us this by playing with the empty box after opening hundreds of dollars worth of toys. We just have decided not to listen with our eyes. Children. Being a mom has put me on their side. I believe in them and I'm trying harder to listen to their silent communication, to do better things for the world we live in, to care about hugs and kisses, about laughter and play, sleeping and eating, experiencing the awe of wild animals and places, make believing in a pretend world that you base your dreams on and strive for, caring for others so we can all be friends, and live safely, because helping and being a good helper is one of the most valued compliments that children could hear.
And that's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Catch our repeat Fridays after Alaska News Nightly on AM 670 and find most of our stories online. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. See you next week.